So last night, President Trump comes out and he says that he's upset that Putin is killing people, which is really kind of a strange thing to say about a president who is the president of a country which is at war. Also, more Ukrainian soldiers are, get this, switching sides on the battlefield. They're now fighting alongside Russia. You're going to hear why they're doing so. Meanwhile, there is no switching sides in Gaza. There, you're going to hear a very, very blunt assessment from an IDF soldier as to what he thinks should happen in Gaza. Man, wow, get ready for the Sanchez effect. Let's do this. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And I want to start with Mr. Trump, who lately has not failed to disappoint, I'm sorry to say. In fact, it does appear now that the American people, who were once quite encouraged by his presidency, right, including me, are now souring on it. Take a look at this brand new poll. It shows that Mr. Trump's approval numbers have hit today, this morning, an all-time low for this term as president. Only 40% of Americans, 40% now approve of his performance as a president. And by the way, the biggest drop for him is men. Men are that's the group that elected him. So that's a very significant data point. So why are they souring on Mr. Trump? Well, mostly it's because of comments like the one that I'm about to play for you. This one, he made this comment last night on the issue of Russia's conflict with the West, which he doesn't seem to understand. A conflict, by the way, he promised to solve, right? You heard it, in just a matter of days.
Russia could be so rich right now. Instead, they spend all their money on war. They spend everything on war and killing people, and it doesn't make sense to me. I thought he would want to end this thing quickly. I really felt it was going to end. But every time I think it's going to end, he kills people.
Could a meeting help? And are you considering, has been proposed?
I don't know. I'm not, you know, I'm not so interested in talking anymore.
He kills people? It's a war, right? By the way, and by the way, how many wars has the United States been involved in? My country. So let's do this. For the sake of comparison, I want to show you something. Vladimir Putin's approval ratings. And this, by the way, that I'm about to show you, Vladimir Putin's approval ratings, this is not a Russian firm that went out and did this, right? This is not done by the Kremlin or anything like that. This is a Western polling agency. And he is consistently, according to these agencies, right, Putin somewhere around 80%. In fact, here, let me show it to you. Let's put it up. This is a poll conducted annually by Statista. They are not exactly pro-Russian. They're German, by the way. They're not exactly pro-Putin either. More like quite the opposite. And according to their poll, 86% of Russians right now, 86% approve of Mr. Putin. He was around 60%. I looked this up this morning. I was bored, I guess. He was around 60% in 2020, around 80% about 2.5 years ago. And now he's at a whopping 86%. So think about this. Mr. Trump, with barely 40% of Americans approving of him, is telling Mr. Putin, with 86% of his people approving of him, what he's doing wrong. So let's think back now to what Mr. Trump said in that comment, right? Because what I want to do now is I want to show you what a highly decorated American Army colonel, who's a really smart guy, someone I communicate with often, who also happens to know Mr. Trump very well. He was expecting Mr. Trump was going to put him in his administration. I was hoping he would, but he didn't for some reason. Here's what he has to say about Mr. Trump's comments that you just heard.
He's not even in touch with reality, and it all goes back to this underlying assumption. That is that Russia is weak. You remember, it's always about, well, we're the liberal Democrats, we're good people, and he's an authoritarian, a dictator. Well, give me a break. You know, when's the last time we saw the ballot box really work for the American people? The lesson from the Trump administration thus far is that the ballot box is broken and is totally meaningless. It doesn't make any damn difference who you vote for. You get the same terrible outcome. So forget all that stuff. The second part is, well, he's an authoritarian. Well, the Russians are actually thriving. Their economy is in far better condition than ours is. And what have we done that singles us out and distinguishes us? We've stolen $600 billion of sovereign national wealth from Russia.
Good points all around, wouldn't you say? By the way, when it comes to Ukraine, McGregor and many others are going to tell you that this is not a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's not. It's really a war between the United States and Russia, with Ukraine in the middle, stuck there as a proxy, kind of being used, if you know what I mean. Trump, unfortunately, doesn't seem to understand that. He thinks he's a referee and there's a war or a game between two other players. No, you're one of the players. However, you know who does understand what's going on, that this is really a war between the West and Russia? Ukrainian soldiers. You heard me right. Ukrainian soldiers who are now switching sides and have joined the Russian military.
I was in captivity, and I realized that if I returned to Ukraine, I would be thrown back into the trenches, dying once again for a cause that doesn't even exist. I'd be fighting for a worthless government that betrayed me once, and it will betray me again. The government doesn't care whether I live or die. They've lined their pockets with money, and at the first opportunity, they'll just run away. Whether it's to the West, Europe, or America, it doesn't matter. They'll take that money and leave the people of Ukraine to perish.
Isn't that amazing to hear that? That interview, by the way, was conducted by Patrick Lancaster. He's an American YouTuber who is in Ukraine doing these YouTube entries that you could see for yourself while he's covering the war. And he came across several Ukrainian soldiers who've switched sides, and he put a microphone in front of them. This soldier in particular, by the way, that you just saw there, he worked for Zelensky's presidential brigade. And now he refers to Russians and Ukrainians together as brothers.
When I was imprisoned, the guards commented that I seemed like a decent guy and mentioned a unit that was active at the time. Now it's a battalion. They carry out various missions and fight for different causes. This piqued my interest, so I asked some representatives from that unit to meet with me. When they came, I expressed my desire to join them and fight for Ukraine's freedom. Everyone in this unit has walked the same path as I have. They've made the same choice. It's a voluntary decision to genuinely fight for your country and speak openly without fear. In Ukraine, for instance, I couldn't have done that because the SBU would have arrested me, and who knows what they would have done to me in their dungeons. Now I can speak freely. I'm telling the truth as it is. I can express myself without fearing for my life because I'm here. The people back home are still very much in the dark. Yes, our younger brother is struggling because Ukraine and Russia are like two brothers, one older and one younger. They may squabble over things, but at the end of the day, brothers should always support one another. That's why I believe Russia helps Ukraine, not like the narrative of genocide against the Ukrainian people suggests. Come on, that's utter nonsense. Have you seen how much aviation and weaponry Russia possesses? If Russia had intended to wipe Ukraine off the map, they would have done so long ago. But that hasn't happened.
As I was listening to him and preparing this material so I could share it with you, I came across something he said that really kind of got me. And I thought it was, because it's so human, right? I mean, what you're about to hear now is really poignant, I think, if not the most human moment in this interview. At least it was for me. You decide for yourself. It's when this soldier explains what happened at the moment that he was captured and what happened when he was first approached by Russian soldiers. Here it is.
Initially, I truly believed we were being invaded, that Russian soldiers were the occupiers taking my land. However, I soon realized this perception was misguided. They were not monsters. When I was taken captive, I had already informed my superiors that we would surrender, while two of my comrades refused, and tragically, they were killed during the fighting. As I stepped out of the bunker to surrender, one Russian soldier approached me and said, "Please forgive us, but we've killed two of your men." In that moment, I thought, what's happening? Are these really the occupiers? The ruthless beasts coming to annihilate us? No, they're just people too. They understand that the soldiers of the Ukrainian armed forces have been thrust into this conflict against their will.
Different story than the one we hear from President Trump, is it? They actually went and apologized for what they had done. And by the way, as you watch this, right, you think the Kremlin must have put that together. It's got to be a propaganda film or something. No! You could go see this yourself. It's on YouTube, and the dude who's doing it is just a guy who went there from the United States. He's an American, and he's been putting out these videos. And I just learned there's a whole battalion of former Ukrainians who are now fighting for the Russian army. What does that tell you, right? What does that tell you? Soldiers like him and a lot of others among Russians and Ukrainians, both sides, interestingly enough, don't see this war as a personal grudge match between two peoples. That's just not the way they see it. It's so different in that sense compared to other wars. In fact, civilian casualties, you'll never hear this from CNN or any of the other channels or the New York Times. Civilian casualties, you can look this up yourself, I did, have been kept to a remarkable low for a war of such ferocity and length. You know how many civilian casualties there have been? I know, one person, one civilian dying is one too many. I understand it. But the number of this war that's almost been 3 years now, 13,300. That's, all things considered, extremely low when you compare it, for example, to the war in Iraq. Just to name one, I could name many more. It's estimated hundreds and hundreds of thousands of civilians died in the U.S. war in Iraq. Mr. Trump, using a more current example, how about the war in Gaza? It's already estimated the civilian death toll there stands at six. This is the official death toll, by the way, 60,000. 18,500 of those are children. That war has been going on for half as long as the war in Ukraine. Unlike Russians and Ukrainians, Israelis and Palestinians see their conflict as a real grudge match. This is where, you know, their hatred of each other is extremely evident. Not so between the Russians and the Ukrainians. In fact, I want you to listen to something else. I found this and I thought it was also extremely poignant. Listen to these two IDF soldiers describe what they see as their mission in Gaza. Here it is.
What do you think about the bombs in Gaza? Do you think they should continue to bomb Gaza?
Flood the city, no people.
Really, no people. There are 1 million. There are 1 million children in Gaza. You think we should? You think you should kill them all? You said you wanted Gaza to be completely flat with no people left. Those are your words that came out of your mouth.
After our hostages come back, then bomb Gaza.
When the hostages come back, you'll bomb Gaza?
I want that.
So when the hostages return, you want to bomb Gaza?
Yeah.
Did I say grudge match? When we come back, we're going to talk about this. We are delighted to have Aviv Bushinsky, a former media advisor, spokesperson at one time for the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, so we can better understand the Israeli perspective on all of this. I am very excited about this interview. I hope you are too. We're going to do this when we come back. Stay right there.
If you think about Russia, what does your mind picture? What landscapes open up before your eyes? What wonders can you imagine? Peter Scott starts the journey. Are you ready to come along?
Towards the end of the 18th century, a wave of decolonizations caused the colonizers to focus their attention on Africa.
A period marked by the brutal legacy of European imperialism and the systematic exploitation of African peoples and resources.
Many of our nations remain caught in the grip of neo-colonial systems.
Africans must be the lords of their own land, the masters of their own resources.
It is time to leave Africa and other developing countries alone. The West needs to stop with the foreign interference.
They know that a divided Africa is a weak Africa.
Let us challenge the poisonous tongues that seek to divide us and build bridges of understanding instead.
Today, that opportunity lies in cooperation with nations across the global south and with allies like Russia.
Welcome back to the Sanchez Effect. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know, it seems like every day now we see these horrible scenes of what the United Nations and countries all over the world have been calling a genocide that is taking place in Gaza. However, and to be fair, if you want to talk about this properly or fairly, it's really important to point out what Israelis argue. And they argue this point quite vehemently, that this thing really began October 7th, about a year and a half ago. I mean, that's when I was shocked, the world was shocked. Members of Hamas crossed into Israel and they killed as many as 1,200 people, including mostly civilians. I mean, it was a horrific attack. A war crime, by the way. War crime as described by the United Nations as well. But obviously, since then, the attention has turned to the actions of Israel instead. Aviv Bushinsky is a former media advisor. By the way, he's a former journalist as well, which is great to hear because I think it's always good to have somebody with a journalism perspective to be able to share a conversation with. He was a spokesperson for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and he's also served as the chief of staff when Netanyahu was the finance minister. So with all that behind us and ahead of us, I welcome Aviv here to our to the Sanchez Effect. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rick. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So you know what? Let me give you a little bit of my background. I'm from Miami. I was born in Cuba. And because I was raised in Miami, I was always around Jews, right? The quarterback of my football team, Glenn Jones, God, I love that guy. He was my best friend. I would spend the night at his house. His mom would cook for me. He would spend the night in my house. My mom would cook for him. In fact, the term in Miami, Juban, is very common, as I'm sure you probably know, because I'm sure you've been to Miami. It means Juban. It means Jewish and Cuban, right? So the whole idea of being around, you know, the Jewish culture, for me as an American, is something I'm very, very proud of. And that's why I kind of wanted to have this conversation with you, almost as if you were one of the guys I grew up with, which you very well could have been in Miami. It hurts me personally to see what's happening to Jews and to Israelis around the world. We've got this video that we just got in from Greece, for example, where people didn't even let a ship come in because they thought it has Israeli Jews on board. That's terrible that this would be happening to people who I'm sure are very good people. But this thing has catalyzed in such a way, Aviv, that I fear, and you know, I fear that what Bibi and his government are doing is hurting Israel and hurting what is the spirit and the culture of Jews around the world. And it's something that's gonna be going on for a long time. And you know, pardon me for saying this, because you know, I shouldn't be talking about other people's culture, but as a journalist, I feel it's a fair question.
Yes, it is. Of course it is. By the way, just to round the story, my father was an editor in the Miami Herald. He grew up as an American, and naturally he lived in Miami 100 years ago. Going back to your question, first of all, yes, it is embarrassing, it's annoying, it's depressing. The fact that the Israelis are being hunted all over the world only because of what is happening in Gaza. Most of the people who hunt the Israelis don't know even the facts. We had the Tomorrowland Festival in Belgium. The Israeli famous, worldwide famous DJ was expelled from the event, but under his expense, another guy, a Palestinian with a Palestinian flag, conducted the event. Same happened in Spain. People who spoke Hebrew were asked to disembark the plane, and I can give you tons of examples. Israeli sports team are forbidden to participate, and unfortunately, people in Russia know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. We are now some kind of a persona non grata in the world. And why? Because a terrorist organization, the Hamas is a terrorist organization recognized in many Western countries as a terrorist organization, decided to launch an attack on Israel, try to annihilate, to dismiss Israel's existence. Unlike, and this is the important thing, unlike the Palestinian Authority, which governed the rest of the Palestinian areas, and we have some kind of collaboration, talks, hopefully we'll have a resolution as a expanding the Oslo Accord, as you all remember. This is one thing. The second thing is, to just to put things in perspective, is Israelis don't control Gaza. Gaza was taken by the Hamas from the Palestinian Authority, and they are there. Exactly 20 years ago, and this was even after the Oslo Accord, our Prime Minister, late Prime Minister Sharon, decided to unilaterally disengage from the Jewish towns surrounding Gaza. And look what happened. He thought that it was going to be some kind of a bona fide, we'll show that we want peace with the Palestinians. Mm. And in return, we got the ordeal of October 7th, and way before the October 7th, tons of missiles, even today, were launched to all kinds of places, even to my house in Tel Aviv. Why? Because they don't want us, not in Gaza, they don't want us in the land of Israel, they don't want us in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, you name it.
Well, let me just say this, and I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of Hamas and where they started or how they started, but there are plenty of intelligent, respectable people who would say that having Hamas in power is exactly what Bibi Netanyahu wanted. And it's kind of a deal that was struck through Qatar, and he wanted to create that enemy so then he could take his boogeyman down. But I don't want to go there. I want to talk about this with you, if I can, respectfully. I have a feeling that what you said is true, and that at that moment, October 8th, when the world woke up and saw those pictures, they were on your side, and they were really angry at what Hamas had done. Since then, Israel has overstepped. It's gone bloodthirsty crazy in what it's done. Look at these pictures. Look at these pictures we have that are coming out of Gaza. These are children that you're about to look at here who are freaking starving. I mean, Aviv, I almost want to say to you as a brother, I don't care what your excuse is. You personally should be going in there and helping these little children. They're being starved, and don't give me this thing about Hamas is not letting the food in. The actions by the IDF look terrible in terms of 18,500 dead children. At some point, somebody in your government has to say, enough, let's stop this. I get it, what they did was wrong. But what Israel and Bibi Netanyahu's government is doing also appears wrong too, man. No?
Okay, so no, not exactly. I tend to disagree with you, Rick, because first of all, you have to remember that there are still, out of the 250 hostages that were taken from Israel to Gaza, the ones who were not killed or raped. I didn't know that raping is part of a normal war that one conduct against the other, but let's put it aside. Out of the 250 that were kidnapped, we still have 50 in Gaza. Those 50, the Hamas is not willing to release those 50. Not only that they don't want, that they are unwilling to release the 50 hostages, most of them are unfortunately are dead. Mm-hmm. They are unwilling to even let the Red Cross see their condition or give them a minimum food or medical aid that they do need, because we know that they do need. So this is the situation is not over. It's not a revenge that we are conducting a war against Gaza because they did bad things to us. It's an ongoing issue that we still have with the Hamas. The Hamas doesn't take down its armament against Israel. They still have their tunnels, they still have their missiles. And it's not that we'll go out from there and say, you know, enough is enough. This is one thing. Second of all, just not that I'm Not that it's not important, but the figures are not accurate. It's not 85,000 kids dead in the war.
This no, it's, is I a said number 8,000. No,
Hamas.
I said 8,000.
I don't want to compare.
But hold on. I said 8,000.
Okay.
I didn't say 85,000.
Well, 1 second. Okay. I don't want to go into. Okay. So my wrong. Sorry. But let's go to numbers. And it's wrong to compare numbers because every innocent dead person is terrible. But when the United States launched its war against the Al-Qaeda, after one incident, the 9/11 incident, then they flew to Afghanistan to eliminate bin Laden. How many people were killed? 250,000 people were killed. Most of them are either insurgents or innocent people.
Yeah.
When President Putin decided to bring an end to the Chechens, after the endless terrorist mm-hmm. attack that the Chechen launched on mainly on Moscow, what did they do? He killed, according to the numbers, 150 people because of a few hundreds of Chechens that launched a terrorist attack. And this was not only a land dispute, it was even more complicated. So I don't want to get to it, and I don't want to get to the numbers. But the issue is that we have nothing, but nothing to do in Gaza. My friends are in reserves, are fighting there. I have friends that were killed in action. We want to go back to Miami to see, I don't know what, to play golf and paddle and to see Messi playing in Miami, okay? But unfortunately, this situation was imposed on Israel.
Yeah.
And as long as this regime is holding Israeli people and intends to continue its jihad war against Israel, we have no alternative. The best thing is, you know what, okay, let's forget about it, let's go away, and whatever will be, will be. So we are trying to, one more word, I'll complete it. We're trying to maneuver between the issues, and therefore Israel is letting now a food and supplies to Gaza. Imagine a country that is fighting a war, or let's say Russia is fighting a war against Ukraine, simultaneously help the Ukrainians in these places. So this is an awkward situation, but I don't think that anyone has the formula to say, okay, you know, enough is enough. Let's forget about it. Let's forget about our hostages and let those Hamas terrorists rearm themselves and continue their jihad war against Israel.
But is it fair to call this? I mean, you just made a comparison that I happen to think doesn't really fit. You know, the idea that you can call this a war when those people have been living there with checkpoints controlled by the IDF and the U.S. military, you control where they...
No, not in Gaza. No.
No?
No, not in Gaza. So they free to Israel... No.
Free to come and go.
No Israeli is going into Gaza. Military, civil, no.
But can they go...
They're there. We have nothing to do there.
Can they go into Israel? Can they go into the Israel proper without having to go through checkpoints or anything else? They can go to Tel Aviv. No, they can't. They have to be. They have to be.
First of all, they can't. Why? Because the ones who got the permits to go, you know, they used to work in Israel.
Yeah.
They used this opportunity. Not all of them, but many of them used this opportunity to launch terror attack in Israel. Unfortunately, of course, they used to come. So they cannot cross the border, but they can go and cross the border with Egypt if they want.
The
Egyptians doesn't want them, but this is a different issue. But it's not the only country in the world that one cannot cross the border to another country. I can't cross the border to Lebanon.
The point, they don't want me there. The point I'm making is these people are captive. The better example would be, let's use Miami as an example. You know Miami, right? Let's suppose there were people in Hialeah mm-hmm. or Miami Springs or some part of Miami, and there were people there who were against the government of Miami and the mayor, and they had shot somebody or acted out or even done some terrorism. So now the city of Miami, using its military, was going to simply attack that city and all the people who lived there because there were some people there who were very bad. The problem I think that your country has right now is that it's looking like you're not really going after Hamas, though I understand that Hamas is there, it's looking like you're trying to eliminate the Palestinians who are or are not necessarily members of Hamas. Please make me understand that if I'm wrong.
No, first of all, most of the Palestinians live in Samaria, in the West Bank, what we call it, between the border of Egypt and Israel, okay? Around Jerusalem, around the Jericho, around the Jordan Valley. And they live there. You don't see Israelis go there, bomb there, launch their missile, their jets, and try to kill as many Palestinians we can. On the contrary, they come to Tel Aviv, we go there. It's not tranquility, but something is working. In Gaza, it's a different community that was taken over, as I said, by the Hamas. Hmm. And the Hamas imposed itself. If the Palestinian Authority could have taken over, which it was a different story. This is one thing. The second thing, if you know, one inclined that we indiscriminately launch our missiles and try to kill as many people as we want. So how can you explain the fact that Israel, before it launches its drones or its planes or its missiles, we have the knock on the roof concept that we tell the civilians, the innocent people, look, we're going to bomb this neighborhood, we're going to bomb this place, please go out, please stay away, because we are hunting the terrorists. This is what we are doing. And unfortunately, many soldiers were killed because they had to alternate between places and not just, okay, you know what, let's send a 500-kilo bomb and kill as many people as we can. This is not the object. The object is to get rid of this phenomena that one wants to kill you, has a distorted ideology with jihad, and I think that the world should look at it more carefully, and the fact that we have those Israelis, and by the way, also some non-Israelis that were taken on October 7th. If they would have released all of them, it would have been a total different story. We have nothing to do here. We're spending time, energy, money, and lives in a war which no one wants.
But don't you see how a lot of people around the world are looking at this? And, of course, the people who are, you know, anti-Semitic to begin with are going to be, you know, even more pressing on some of these issues, which becomes a problem, I understand, as well. And I respect that point of view. But don't you see how people are going to look at this as, like, this could have been more of a police action? Going back to the example again, somebody goes into my home and, heaven forbid, kills a member of my family, right? And then they go back and hide in a 10-story building. And what you're saying is we have the right now to go and bomb that 10-story building, eliminate it, just like the pictures we saw there, because the guy who killed somebody in my home, I'm not going to use the police to go and catch him. I'm just going to destroy the building he lived in. Oh, and if people didn't get the message that they were told, I guess, whenever, that they have to get out of the building, didn't hear it, tough crap. They're going to die, too. And that's how people are seeing this, Aviv. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but that's not what the world is seeing.
I respect your views, and I understand. And I, as a former journalist, I know, you know, things. It's easy to show pictures with a starving kid and not the aggressor with the F-15. Okay, and to talk about the minority or people that just want to get food, that the Israelis that enjoy their lives are, I don't know what, have this habit to kill Palestinians. Right. But first of all, it's not a police work that Israel can just cross to Gaza and do whatever it wants. Gaza, it has a border with Israel. We cannot just cross there and I don't know what, collect. Collect fines or do a regular or give driving tickets. It's a different place. This is one thing. Second of all, the terrorists understood the rule of the game. So they are deliberately hiding among civilians or under the hospitals in Gaza. That's why it prolonged the war. The Israeli forces had to go physically to those places and find the terrorists one by one, really to pick one and one and one. Not, okay, let's bomb everyone and get rid of it. This is not, or they used to hide in mosques. Did Israel bomb mosques because we like to bomb mosques and to see the towers fall? No, this is not the issue.
Yeah.
They use it. This is how a terrorist organization acts. And unfortunately, we are caught in between the fact that we want to release our hostages and the bad pictures. Yes, I admit, the bad pictures that are being seen all over the world. And I don't want to talk even about anti-Semitism, that it fits their view or their agenda.
Of course, there's always...
One is, so to speak, the aggressor. And the other one is the poor Palestinian that has nothing to do. But I think that we are fighting something that if we will not be able to overcome this phenomena... So other places, they'll understand that this is the way how you manipulate, how you twist the arm of a democratic country that has its laws, that wants to be a normal country among the rest of the nations. Well, and unfortunately, at the moment, in terms of how people portray it, they succeed.
Yeah, no, listen.
They succeed.
And this is why we're having this conversation. I'm sick and tired of turning on the TV and seeing people screaming at each other about this, which is why, you know, as a fellow journalist, I'd rather see we have disagreements, but we can have the semblance of a respectful conversation. I want to, you know, my job is to try and understand your perspective while challenging you at the same time. And I'll tell you, what the Israeli army, the IDF, and the Bibi Netanyahu government is doing so far in Gaza does not look judicious. It does not look judicious. It looks, in fact, like they're going in there to destroy. My fellow Americans are very angry right now, especially the Christians, that suddenly they bombed a Christian church recently in the area, and they're very angry. And I understand, because it's looking like it's careless. Aviv, I've seen evidence of people who were killed that it didn't look like they were accidentally killed because they were in the wrong place. It looks like they have a hole in their skull because a sniper took them out, and they are children or food workers or journalists. Somebody like you has to stand up and accept the responsibility and say, we made a mistake, we screwed up, we're so sorry. Instead, it's always, no, it's Hamas's fault. That's another point I wanted to bring to you, with all due respect, my brother.
No, I appreciate it, and you're right. With the incident with the church, Israel was wrong. Israel apologized. Netanyahu made a phone call to the Pope asking to apologize.
Yeah.
I don't remember that it doesn't happen on a daily basis. Israel is not indifferent with such phenomena. I know my friends, Rick. My friends are the most moral people you can find, with a westernized education. They don't have any fetch or hobbies to go and kill as many Palestinians, and they have like a competition and count on how many people did you kill today. Mm. This is not the story. They're trying to find and catch the terrorists. You know how risky it is when my friends, that they go to the tunnels in Gaza, trying to find hostages, trying to eliminate munitions, RPGs, Kalashnikov, you name it. And they go physically underground where it all covers with booby traps and whatever. A normal army should, you know what, it's too dangerous, let's bomb this place and that's it. This is not the story.
Hmm.
This is not how we operate. It's a very, very complicated operation that Israel is conducting, trying to minimize the number of victims. And yes, war does not look good on TV, but you need to understand people. I know that you know, but people need to understand the facts and the manipulation that is being done in order to twist Israel's arm and say, you know, Israel, stop it. And, you know, and surrender to terror, because this will be the outcome. And I'm not mentioning the hostages that are there, but surrender to terror, and the Hamas will show the world, you see, we took the mighty old Israel, we managed to kick Israel away, and now the next step is Jerusalem. This is the story.
But
is what they are saying. Their next phase is Jerusalem. It's not Gaza. This is not their story. Not at all.
But it's feeding what... again, going back to the point you and I were talking about when we started this conversation, sharing our stories about your dad working at the Miami Herald and my being a journalist who also had associations with the Miami mm-hmm. Herald, it's feeding the stereotype. I've been to Israel. It's a wonderful place with wonderful people who are some of the most delightful, the most welcoming, the most educated people in the world. And by the way, so are Jews in general, as a people. Just like we could say the same thing about Protestants or Catholics or a lot of other people all over the world. So I get that. What bothers me is, at this point in time in our existence on this planet Earth, people are looking at Jews and not thinking that way because of this. So at some point, I worry that for you and other Israelis, that you got to get a handle on this. Even in America, my friends in America who've always been pro-Israel are going like, enough with Israel. We're tired of seeing Bibi Netanyahu walk into the Congress like he owns the damn place. And we're tired of seeing politicians in the United States taking hundreds of millions of dollars from Israel to direct foreign policy. And Americans are saying, well, what if we disagree with foreign policy? They're saying, you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't hear. This is conversations going on every day in America. Well, tough luck. You have to buy whatever Israel says the foreign policy is. So these are real problems that Israel's going to have to deal with, whether they're perceived or real or manufactured. Do you get my drift?
So first of all, I did. Yeah, Israel, first of all, does it only, it takes, it always give, it also give. Israel, the Israelis managed to, did many things in the world of innovation. I don't want to flatter and to talk great things about Israelis, but Israel has a lot to do to the culture, to science, etc.
No question.
And what happened in the meantime in Gaza? What are they focusing? What are they focusing on? Not on developing ways or the cardiac stent or whatever. They were focusing, and still today, in building those tunnels. You know how many kilometers of underground tunnels that were built in Gaza? And Gaza is a tiny little place. In comparison to any other land in the world, more than 600 or 700 kilometers underground tunnels in Gaza, not to a subway station. Even the subway station in New York doesn't have 700 kilometers underground, not even the tube in London. Those places that they dug underground and billions of dollars were taken from the world instead of aid and building a normal, vibrant place in Gaza, the money was taken by the Hamas to build those underground places for this specific mission, to take hostages and to put them on the ground, that they won't see daylight and the Israeli IDF will not be able to release them. And to put all their arms and smuggle their arms and maneuver from one place to other and use those tunnels to infiltrate into Israel and do those attacks on the kibbutzim, on the places that live across the border. This is what they were focusing and still are focusing on. So, yes, I'm upset. I'm upset that, to be an Israeli now and to go overseas, you need to lay low. Maybe don't show your Magen David. Don't speak Hebrew in places where you don't need to speak Hebrew. And why? Did we go and indiscriminately kill people? Is this our mission to just take the M16 and spread everybody in a building in New York? No, this is not the story. And I think that the greatest danger, and Rick, you mentioned it, ignorance is the big menace to society. And you were talking about how people see the role of Russia and how the Ukrainians see the Russians. And you said that there's a lot of false story and wrong attitude towards the what's being done or the relationship between the Ukrainians and the Russians because of, one, ignorance.
Yeah.
Some of them are ignorant. And twisted, distorted media coverage. And I think that this is the result. Politics, let's put it aside. Bibi's not the perfect guy. His successor is not the best guy. His predecessor is not the best guy. But this is democracy. They are not being elected to, by the definition, how many Arabs or Palestinians they'll be able to kill. No, this is not the story.
You know, the Palestinians would say that everything that happened prior to October 7th should be considered as well. You've heard it, 7 decades of settler colonization, colonialism, and they felt like they have been put upon, and on October 7th, they were just reacting to all that anger that they had inside of them. We don't have to argue out the history because we'll be here all day, but do you ever get a sense that somebody in the Israeli government should at some point try and meet the problem halfway and say, we understand the frustrations? We may have made mistakes. You've made mistakes, too. How do we figure this out so both peoples can live in peace? Is that even a viable option at this point, Aviv?
Oh, yeah, of course, of course. Wow, I can outline the number of mistakes that Israel done and the numbers of mistakes that the Palestinians did. From the establishment of Israel as an independent state in 1948, and the fact that the Arabs at that time rejected it, and the law had the war, et cetera, et cetera, the Six-Day War, and the fact that we did conquer some land, and the Palestinians were not satisfied with many things that Israel offered, yeah. And then we had the Oslo Accord in the early 90s, trying to establish some kind of a Palestinian authority that this eventually will become the Palestinian state. So, but I don't want to talk about history because, as you said, we don't have much time.
Yeah, we'll be
but
here forever.
One fact.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the Palestinian authority that yeah, exactly. So, unfortunately, the fact that once the Palestinian authority was created, and at that time that the terrorist Arafat came back and he took over in an agreement with Israel to be the leader or the president of the Palestinian Authority, they got, as I said, areas, the areas in the West Bank and Gaza to the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority lost Gaza to the Hamas. So now you ask yourself, okay, let's make a deal with the Palestinian Authority. Mm-hmm. Who are their leaders now? Is it the Palestinians in Gaza, the Palestinians in Beit Lechem, in Hebron, in other places? So it's a mess. And the Israelis now have some kind of a fatigue because they said, you know, we've tried. We tried the peace in Oslo. It kind of failed. We did the disengagement from Gaza 20 years ago. It failed. So I don't know what will be, but I think that the first step fetching for tranquility is getting rid of the Hamas, because a terrorist organization should not exist, not only in Gaza, in the world, period. Not in Chechnya, not in the Netherlands, and not in, I don't know where, in Miami Beach.
What about getting rid of Bibi Netanyahu? Would that solve the problem? Because he really has come across as a bit of a bully throughout all this. And when you look at the Bibi files and you see some of the things and the shenanigans that he was up to, one can't help but wonder, whether one's a journalist or not, whether he's doing this because he's trying to stay in power. I know I'm not the first person who's asked you this question. How would you answer it?
It's a tough question. There's also Israelis that think that some of the things that he currently does is in order to stay in power. First of all, to put things in perspective, I used to work for Netanyahu.
Of course.
For 8 years, and I'm no longer working for him. I am independent. I do lots of analysis, so I'm not speaking on his behalf, not in favor or disfavor. But getting rid of Bibi Netanyahu, which some people in Israel do think that it's about time after, I don't know what, maybe Queen Elizabeth stayed in power more than Netanyahu. It's elections, and elections we will have mostly in a year and a half from now, and then everybody can decide whether they want to throw him up out or let him stay again for I don't know what for how many because we don't have any limitations on terms. But I think that to say that it's all about Bibi, and I heard this accusation, it's the easy way to look at things. Yes, easy. Yeah, Bibi is tough. Okay, there's another scenario that say, you know what, as you mentioned, Rick, let's forget about it. Let's say, let's ask the Hamas to release all the hostages. Israel will stop fighting in Gaza. And maybe in a year from now, 2 years from now, when we'll have another cycle, we'll go and I'm sorry for the wording. I don't know a better way to phrase it. And then we'll kick their asses. Okay?
Yeah.
But what Bibi says, enough is enough. We had too many cycles, and he wants to do something more fundamental, if I can say. Mm. So maybe it doesn't look like. I agree that his the way he portrays portray things, the way he speaks, that he walks, and he shows how Trump is such a good friend of his. Maybe it's like it's too much. It's like a bull's eyes behavior.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that his approach in general. Most Israelis adhere to his approach, and they think that that this is what we need to do to get rid of this danger. The question is mainly about the tactics, not about the goal.
Right.
It's not that Bibi, again, as I said, okay, let's kill a few more Arabs and then everybody will be happy in Israel. This is not the story. You know what? Frankly, we hardly talk about, and maybe this is something that is not politically correct to say, we hardly talk about the numbers of Palestinians or terrorists that were killed. We are more focusing on the number of the soldiers that were killed in action.
Well, you know, Aviv, you represent your point well, and I really want to thank you for taking time. I know this is a really difficult thing to talk about, and I wanted to have just a conversation. I mean it, man, and I know you've seen it, too. Every time I turn on the TV, I get somebody representing the Palestinian perspective and somebody representing the Israeli perspective, and they're just screaming at each other at the top of their lungs and calling each other names. And I think that doesn't seem to resolve anything. There's got to be a better way. Yeah, you and I disagree on a lot of things, obviously. But that doesn't mean we can't have a conversation about something that's incredibly important to the rest of the world as well, and obviously to Palestinians and Israelis, and at least talk about some potential solutions. And I think the more we talk about it in this fashion, probably the closer we'll get to finding that solution. So that's why I want to thank you for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you for listening and asking the good questions. And I think that maybe we'll move from the battlefield either to chess or to WWF, and then we'll solve the issues this way instead of in the war zone, which nobody likes.
Well, yeah, no, listen, I read your background, and it says that you are a chess champion. So I know that makes you, if nothing else, somebody that's quite formidable in these parts right here. And that's maybe why I had to prepare a little extra for this interview, knowing that you would be able to try and check me with everything I said. But I thank you once again, Aviv. Thank you for taking time to take us through your arguments, and you represent them very well. Thank you, sir. Well, that's it for us. And, you know, I hope we can bring you more conversations like that. You know, it's about light and it's about heat. And sometimes in these conversations, a lot of that is involved. The idea of being able to challenge somebody to give you the answers. You can't make people think what you think, but you can ask them the questions about what the world may be thinking that may not necessarily posture them in a good light. That's what we try to do. Look for truths. You can call and check out my podcast, by the way. It's called Journalistically Speaking. It's on YouTube. You can find it, and it's where we put a lot of other bonus stuff as well. You can also see me on X. And by the way, I read all the comments. That's at Rick Sanchez TV. We'll be looking for you again. See you next time. I'm Rick Sanchez. Adios.